Hi, everybody. It's Jim Bakeye. The podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. And I'm really lucky to have today Larry Zelvin, who is the head of cybersecurity at the Bank of Montreal and has a very fascinating past. He's had some pretty interesting stints in his life, and he's an American and working for the Bank of Montreal. So, Larry, welcome. And why don't you tell my podcast listeners a little bit about your history and what you've been doing in your life?
Sure, Jim. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and also your listeners. Yeah, a little bit about me. I'm an American. I grew up in the New York area. My father worked on Wall Street his entire career in publishing predominantly. And when I graduated high school, all my friends pretty much went to Wall Street. And I didn't want to do that. I saw how hard my dad was working and how hard a lot of my father's friends were working. And I'm like, you know, I just want to do something else. I grew up in the age of space flight, right? So when I was young, my dad used to give me all these really cool glossy pictures from NASA, right? And I'm like, wow, I want to do this. And, you know, these astronaut guys seem really, really cool. And back in those days, all the astronauts were military pilots. So I said, okay, great. If I'm going to be an astronaut, I got to be a military pilot. So set my sight on, you know, I'll do that first step. But then when I started school, I found out that Matt and I weren't really friends. So being an astronaut really probably wasn't it, but I kept that passion for flying. And I started flying when I was 16 years old, started with gliders. I went to college in Boston University. I was a political science major. And then in my senior year, went into a Navy recruiter, the United States Navy recruiter. It was just before spring break. Applied for the program, came back from spring break, and I got this big envelope, said, report to Pensacola, Florida, June. And I went, holy crap, I joined the Navy.
That really happened.
It really happened. Yeah. And my plan was, Jim, in my mind, is if they accepted me, I'd show up maybe around September, October, take the summer off. But I'm like, wait a minute, I graduated in May. What do you mean I got to show up in June? Did all that. Was a naval aviator. I was in the United States Navy for 26 years. But when I wasn't at sea or in the air, I was in this horrible place called Washington, D.C. I think what brought me to cyber, interestingly enough, is I went to the United States Naval War College when I was a lieutenant commander, major equivalent, mid-grade officer. And I had orders to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, similar to the Canadian Defense Staff in Ottawa. And my job was to be the Canadian desk officer. So I advised the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Canada. I got to spend a lot of time in Ottawa. I negotiated the NORAD agreement between Ottawa and Washington, D.C. And in July of 2001, we stood up something called the Homeland Security Division. At the time, Washington was concerned about chemical, bio, and this thing that eventually became cybersecurity. Fast forward a little bit, September 11th, 2001, saw the World Trade Center get hit. As I said, I was a pilot. I'm like, how the heck did somebody hit the World Trade Center? That doesn't make any sense. Saw the second World Trade Center get hit, knew it was terrorism. And then a short time thereafter, I heard a very loud explosion at the Pentagon. We had been hit. The thing that was different is that I was one of the few places in the world that had a Homeland Security shingle on the door. So myself and a number of other officers were, how do we defend North America from within? And again, NORAD was paramount Canadian U.S. command. Off we go. Let me fast forward. Commanded a squadron down in Florida, rode three hurricanes out while I was there. And then I got recalled back to the Pentagon to work on Secretary of Defense's staff to help with Hurricane Katrina relief. When President Obama came into power, I was asked, would you like to work at the White House? I said, yeah, that'd be okay. So for 3 years, I was at the National Security Council, similar to the Privy Council in Canada. This is my second pandemic, but we worked the H1N1 pandemic. Then we had, I think, Haiti earthquake, BP oil spill, and the largest disaster I ever worked with, Japan earthquake, tsunami, nuclear disaster. So at this point, you should be saying, don't ever let this guy back in Canada and get him out of banking, let alone cyber. But when I was at the White House, it became very apparent that, you know, every time there was something going on at the West Wing, they would turn to us and go, what do you do? And I was worried about cyber. So I started engaging with the president's cybersecurity team, started working with FEMA, similar to Emergency Preparedness Canada. And we started designing, what would the nation do? How would we advise the president if there was a major cyber attack? My very last day at the White House, we had about a 3-hour meeting with President Obama and his cabinet where we ran him through a cyber scenario. And it's fascinating. First time in the history of the United States, a sitting president talked about cyber and cyber crisis management. The next morning, I showed up to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. I retired from the Navy. I ran one of three U.S. government cyber centers. My counterparts were at the FBI. The other one was at NSA. So for almost 3 years, I was securing the .gov in the United States, working with industry, really exciting work. And then when I was at DHS, I had these weird people called executive recruiters calling me. And apparently there were a bunch of banks and energy companies in the United States that wanted to talk to me. And I was like, why? Why in God's name would they want to talk to me? So I started going around to major banks and some of the energy companies and eventually landed at Citigroup. And I was at Citigroup for 4.5 years. I was a managing director and the global head of cybersecurity at Citi. Eventually, I had another bank call and that's led me up north. So hopefully that wasn't too much.
No. It's perfect. It's great. And I mean, thank you for sharing that. And I remember when you and I first met, I was just as jaw-dropping, awed of that kind of a life and career. But how ironic, right? Life is full of serendipity. Full circle. I don't want to go to Wall Street because my dad worked too much. Those guys are all idiots on Wall Street, blah, 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 blah. And there you go, to the largest bank probably at the time in the world and the most iconic Wall Street organization. And then out of the blue comes this Bank of Montreal, knocks on your door and says, we need help.
Yeah, no, it was actually, again, you know, how the stars and the moon align. When we were at Citigroup, I had three fusion centers, one in the New York area where I'm in now, one in Budapest, Hungary, another one in Singapore, follow the sun methodology. When we were there, we had over 7,000 folks come visit us. And one of the 7,000 was a gentleman by the name of Daryl White. And Daryl is the CEO of BMO. He had recently become the CEO. And as you know, BMO had a breach not too long after Daryl took over. And Daryl was on a mission to go figure out, how do you do this right? Right? Who's leaders in this space? How do I figure this out? Daryl brought most of his EC, to include my current boss, Steve Tennyson, with him. And they spent 3 hours with us. And they said, wow, this is great. You know, thank you so much. And, you know, I thought that would end it. And I'm like, you know, wow, I wish them well. A couple of months later, I'm coming back from an international trip from Kennedy Airport, and a recruiter calls me up and he goes, hey, I've got this bank. They want to do cyber fraud, physical security, you know, and potentially crisis management. I said, well, what's the bank? He said, BMO. Have you ever heard of them? I said, well, yeah. I said, I met their CEO and their entire executive committee. I said, well, they know me. And if they want to have the conversation, I'd welcome it. I talked to my boss, Steve. We spent about an hour together. Steve was very excited. I was very excited. And then they made me come to Toronto. And I met with folks for about 10 hours straight. And Daryl was the last one. And so I guess it went okay because they hired me. And I've been at BMO now for about 2 years and 5 months and really enjoying it. And it's been a really fun and exciting journey.
So some of my listeners, and I didn't know what a fusion center was either, but maybe sure. You could just give us a clue on what a fusion center is.
Go back to the 9/11 experience, because I think it's most germane. But, you know, the military has been creating these kind of op centers for years. But we use the 9/11 version. When the United States went back and looked at, you know, how did 9/11 happen? How could this have occurred? One of the things the 9/11 Commission said, it was a failure to connect the dots and was a failure of imagination. So the United States Congress passed a law in 2002 called the Homeland Security Act. And part of the Homeland Security Act, I think I've got the law right, it's been a while, but anyway, told the FBI to open up task force in every major city, joint terrorism task force. So New York, Chicago, LA, I'll stop naming major cities, but the FBI was told, look, get everybody that's involved in terrorism, send them in a damn room, make them talk to each other and work together, right? Connect the dots. Those joint terrorism task force saved lives. They have prevented terrorism, not only in the United States, but in other places around the world. When I was recruited by Citigroup, the question was, could you take somebody like me who had ran, you know, fusion centers at Homeland Security and had done it in the military, and could you apply it to a bank? Could you use it against the cyber problem? Now, as BMO's doing it, the larger security problem. And literally, it is nothing more than getting people together who are all focused on a task, in this case, cyber or security, and getting them all to talk and work together. That's the magic. That's all it really is. But the challenge is in many cases, people, you know, as much as they'd like to work with each other, they don't. So if you don't really force it, if you don't create that mechanism, you just don't get that synergy like I was talking about in terrorism and what I think we've done in BMO across a number of security fields.
So, you know, I remember when we were talking early on and cybersecurity and all the other aspects that you cover now, the challenge is it must be like you're grabbing air, right? You don't see a physical combatant. You don't see a physical opposition. So maybe you could help and take my listeners through from a corporate perspective, sort of how do you think about it all, right? And I know you've put together, you know, the Bank of Montreal is one of the leaders in this area, and you've put together an incredible team of people But the things that you've put in place to be able to, within a second or a minute, find where these breaches or anything else occurs is absolutely phenomenal. But just give me an idea from a psychological perspective when you're facing an unknown.
Yeah, no, Jim, and again, not to scare people, but I mean, I've spent a career, you know, in the military and working against things like counter-narcotics and weapons of mass destruction and terrorism. So for me, cyber is a bit of a vacation. And also when I was in the United States Navy, my primary task back in the Cold War, and I was at the end of the Cold War, but I was still in the Cold War, I hunted submarines, but submarines you can't see either. So in cyber, it's funny, the analysis that I did for submarine hunting is very akin to what we do in cyber in that you're looking at indicators, right? Indicators of compromise. So in a nuclear submarine, you have to keep the reactor cool. So there are pumps going constantly, which creates noise, which creates harmonics in the water. So we listen for the noise. In cybersecurity, we're actually looking for indicators. So we're looking for discrete numbers, right? Because everything across the internet is numbers. And we're looking for numbers that are either known bads or suspicious bads, and things that are good, we leave alone. So it is somewhat abstract, but it's really a cool and fun puzzle if you're kind of demented like me, find hard things and like this fun. But it is literally just about understanding the threat, managing the risk like you manage other risks, and then bringing teams together with really good technology to reduce the risk. But the challenge of it is we only get to play defense, right? There is no offense in our game, right? And we don't want that. Governments can do that, but we're all defense. But it really is what seems rather abstract is more pragmatic, but it requires a lot of effort to do it right.
So I would say that news reports and stuff like that, maybe they've just been overshadowed by the pandemic and all the other things in that. But there was a period of time where we were hearing about cyber attacks all the time, right? And we were hearing about them and someone hacked the head of Sony's email and published them and, you know, whatever they are. And I know it hasn't disappeared, but it does feel like it's off the headlines, off the press. Is that a combination of people sort of get tired of it? Or is it a combination that I don't think you can ever get fully ahead of it, but that people are doing a better job of protecting against it?
I think it's a combination of a number of things. So I think, look, when you talk about, it's not machines that are attacking us, it's rather people, right? And they're people with a motive. And we typically say there are five groups of people. You have nation states, Russia, China, and Iran, North Korea, or for those countries, the United States and Canada and the UK. You have terrorist groups, you have criminals and criminal groups, you have hacktivists, and you have insiders. So five groups of people that are all trying to achieve different means and ends. When it looks at nation states, and look, there has been a lot of attention, particularly now that the Biden administration, and I'm apolitical, right? So I'm not saying yay or nay, but the Biden administration, I think you'll see more and more outing of Russia and China, particularly because of the SolarWinds hacks, the hacks potentially on US elections, and other ways that countries are trying to communicate with other countries and change behaviors between countries, right? So I think you'll be seeing that. But unfortunately, when it comes to nation state attacks, a lot of government information is classified and doesn't get released, but you're seeing a big push to declassify. But I can also say that we've gotten our defenses better. That being said, the criminals and criminal groups, now nations and criminals are starting to work together. And I think North Korea is a great example of that. And again, that's another troubling aspect of all this. On just the normal criminal groups, as you know, because of COVID, many governments are giving money to people who are in need. But I just saw a statistic this morning that 10% of the billions of dollars the United States government has tried to give its citizen, up to 10% of that has been actual fraud.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
so yeah. When you got big money, people are going to go after it. And then, as I said, the you have terrorists who are not too big. The insiders are also a big concern, Jim. And some of that is not because they're trying to do something bad, but rather because people are just not focused and they make mistakes and the repercussions are extraordinary.
You know, when you talk about that 10% of fraud, I remember at 9/11, you'll probably remember this, when they were giving out all the money to the families and things like that. And there was also a large amount of fraud in that. So where does Bitcoin fit into cybersecurity fraud? You know, because I think it's the most fraudulent exchange in the world. I think there's a couple of guys and women that are just pulling a couple of levers here and there, and they're going, okay, let's get it up. Let's get it back down, you know, but it has to play a big role in all of this fraud and cybersecurity, doesn't it?
It does. And look, there are people who love Bitcoin and there are people who don't. And I'm on the don't side. But let me tell you why I'm not a fan of, and I'm not talking as an investor, I'm talking as a security person. So a couple of things. First, Bitcoin is the currency of choice for rogue nation states trying to avoid sanctions and also criminal groups. It's been estimated that upwards of one third of North Korea's GDP is coming from SWIFT attacks, from ATM attacks, and from Bitcoin attacks. Most Bitcoin exchanges, they don't have hardly any security whatsoever. They have no regulator telling them to secure it. So there are a lot of folks, and when it does get broken into, who do you report to, right? Most police departments, they don't have sophistication to deal with like normal cyber crimes. When you talk about the robbing of crypto exchanges and cryptocurrency, it just takes it to a whole new level of sophistication. So it's a pretty much a wild west. So if you want to go after it, nobody's regulating it. And even if it happens, who are you going to tell it to?
And I totally agree. I'm like agnostic to it only from the sense that I just don't get it. Like I don't know a single person who's used a Bitcoin to ever do anything. Everybody talk, oh, the digital currency. And then now we've sort of, I was just talking to someone about this today, this next evolution of, you know, Tesla makes $1.5 billion because they took their treasury money and put it into Bitcoin, but they're losing money building cars, which is what they're supposed to be doing as a company. There are other companies that are taking their treasury money and putting it into Bitcoin, and I'm watching their stocks rise and fall based upon the price of Bitcoin. And we've lost complete control over, you know, what companies are supposed to do. You're supposed to build cars. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do this. You're supposed to do that, right?
Yeah. And Jim, one of the things I worry about, and I don't think I haven't seen it, and I'm hoping that I don't mean to spur public debate, but I mean, as the Bitcoin goes up, do you know that you're increasing funding for terrorists, for child trafficking, for narcotics trafficking, arms trafficking? I mean, it is the currency of choice for all the bad things in human life. And then you worry about the money laundering aspects. I mean, companies just don't have the ability to track this in a way that we can when you use, I don't know, banking and normal finance systems. So I get people are out there making money, but I think as a society, we really haven't yet come to grips with what are the other downstream effects, because, you know, the bad guys are investing too, and we're increasing their currency is now worth more than it used to be.
You know, it's always funny when the opposition of the bad guys or the other team all of a sudden gets further and further ahead and you're playing catch up. And I remember once I read an article that Dick Fisher, who used to run Morgan Stanley, went down to his trading room and he said to one of his traders who had five screens on his desk, and this is early 80s, and he said, "That's incredible. You must be like master of the universe with five screens in your desk." And he goes, "Yeah, five screens is great." He said, "But the clients have seven." And it was, it's just the classic, right? And I'm sure it's the classic when you're dealing with rogue nations or crime or their ability to stay ahead and the money that they generate. And there's no board of directors. There's nothing else. They're so pure in their interest to disrupt or make money. So let's talk about individual people. And, you know, I remember when I came to see your Fusion Center, which was mind-blowing. It was like walking into Nassau the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. You know, you gave me that little statement that sort of made the little bit of hair that I have on the back of my neck stand up. And you said, you know, if I told you the things that go through that phone of yours, you'd never use your phone. Maybe you can talk on a individual basis, what people should worry about and what they should do and how they should think.
Yeah, look, I mean, you got to understand that the threat is real. Do know that tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people wake up every morning with one purpose in mind and one purpose only, and that's to break into somebody's computer. That's what they do. That's how they earn their living. And there's a whole group of them that do it in countries that it's not against the law to do so. It's only against the law that if they do it on their own citizens, so they don't bother. And what I tell people is, you know, it used to be really inconvenient to rob a bank, right? You had to get on a horse or a car, you had to get a weapon, you had to go to a bank, you had to scare everybody, they had to put money in a bag, right? And then you had to get out without getting shot. And then it was really inconvenient. The internet has changed all that. You can rob 1,000 banks or you could rob 100,000 people and never leave your mother's basement. And you'll never be prosecuted because everybody's going, you know what? If you give me a little piece of the action, you don't do anything. It happens. So I think the first thing is people have to realize that the threat is real. The second thing is that folks need to educate themselves. They need to understand what they can do to protect themselves. And, you know, some of the basics, Jim, are, is you know, as you look at your devices, are you keeping them patched? because many of those patches are actually security patches that help protect you. And if you don't do that, they will exploit those things.
Sorry, patch your phone, meaning do your updates.
Software updates, right? And same thing with your application. Make sure you do updates, right? The other thing I recommend people do is you got to keep a really strong eye on your accounts. You really need to watch your money. And if you see anomalies, you got to report it to us, right? And I would also encourage you to do business with organizations that have a strong security program, right? Challenge them and go, hey, what are you all doing to protect my information and my money? And if you don't like the answer, change. It's hard to change your electric company. It's hard to change potentially your natural gas company or others, but you can change your financial. And what I tell our most wealthy clients is that, you know, you may want to consider having a device that you only use to access your investment funds, right? It really keeps it safe. But I would also say is you got to use things like two-factor authentication. So you just don't have one password, you have two. Use biometrics. I can't remember passwords. I hate passwords. So wherever I can, I use my face, my thumbprint, but that makes it really hard. Do know that the adversary is like water, right? The easier it is, the more they'll do it. If you become a hardened target, they'll move on and go somewhere else. And again, you don't want to wish anyone else ill, but you want to be a hard enough target that they're like, you know what? There's easier ways to do this.
It's like my kids used to say to me when we were younger, and I would take the security thing and stick it on my door. And they say, Dad, we don't have a security alarm system on the house. I said, but they don't know that outside.
That's right.
And they'll go to the one next door that doesn't have the sticker on it. Right.
That's exactly right.
So Larry, one more thing about on the individual. What about all these Norton antivirus, all of these different companies? Are they good to have? Do they really protect you or they're just part of everything else? What should we be downloading for ourselves to kind of give us just, obviously nobody's going to have perfect protection, but just to give us a little bit of an edge, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first advice I would have, Jim, is you got to kind of look at your risk posture, right? I mean, you know, if do know that the threat is real. There are certain occasions, like if you have, there are certain companies that I will tell you that do a really good job of security. And I think Apple is one of them, right? Apple really focuses on it. I will, if you have a computer that's 4 or 5 years old, I would absolutely get Norton Antivirus or Symantec, but you got to make your own choices there. You know, the biggest thing I would say is that, you know, when he looks at some of the fraud reporting, I haven't found that personally to be very useful. I find out that actually my bank will tell me before these fraud reporting agencies do. So I think the most important thing is you got to look at what your security posture, do some research, find out who the better companies are around security. If you can't afford or don't have a desire to upgrade your system, then yeah, you should consider other things that you can do. Yeah, unfortunately, you have to be an educated consumer in this space. And you know, the other thing is if you're banking with like Bank of Montreal, BMO, feel free to reach out to our experts. We have folks that would be happy to engage. We have a website that offers this stuff on how to help protect. And we actually have some free software you can download to help protect yourself.
That's fantastic. That's great. So again, like so many things in life, an educate, you know, there used to be, you're from New York, you know, there was that Sims clothing store, right?
And they used to say,
an educated consumer is our best customer, right?
That's right.
You know, in the theme that I've had over many, many podcasts, it's about become educated, right? Understand that it's your responsibility. Obviously, the Bank of Montreal does an incredible job, first of all, in having you and building it and then protecting their clients. But that doesn't remove the responsibility for us as individuals to do the things to protect ourselves. We may never protect ourselves fully, but at least let's make it difficult enough that maybe they go to the next house as opposed to your house.
And Jim, I would offer, I mean, unfortunately, there are two groups that are exploited more than any others when it comes to security. And first are the elderly, and the second are adolescents. So they more than anybody really need to be helped, right? So if you have an older mom or dad or a grandparent or great grandparent, or if you have somebody in their younger years, and younger years is getting younger and younger, I mean, but you have to sit down with folks. You have to let them know the threat's real. They need to know when to tell somebody who maybe have a different sense of things. But I will tell you that I had my father-in-law was duped by somebody. They said my son was injured in an accident, needed money to pay for medical bills. He paid it. They said, oh, we need more money. It was only at that point he called me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you of all people, just call me. And I called my son. He goes, I'm like, how are you? He goes, I'm fine, Dad. It was all a lie.
Yeah, yeah.
All a lie. So do sit down with those folks. Make sure that they, you know, get to chat with others. increase their knowledge of what to do in the bigger schemes out there.
Thanks, Larry. Once again, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Larry Zelvin, the head of cybersecurity at the Bank of Montreal. I'm Jim Bakai. The podcast is BU. The world will adjust.